thanks, Eunice and Una. I have a comment to endorse some of the things that you were saying, Eunice. But I have a question for you, Una. It's my understanding that Brazil, because being less afraid, really, because there's really interesting things happening in Latin America, produced its own generic drugs, which it was exporting, and reversed the increase in HIV. But I read something, I don't know if it was the World Health Organization, have said to India that the generic drugs are inferior.
It's a complicated one. It wasn't that they were inferior. What happened was it was about the way that they tested them. And what you've got to demonstrate with generics, because generics are a copy, you know, of a medication someone else has developed. You've got to show like for like, something like that. And they weren't able to demonstrate this. So in fact, what happened was the World Health Organization took those generics off their list while they were investigating that, but they've subsequently been put back on again. So they were just checking, it was something about the mechanism by which they'd done this comparison. That's my understanding of it, unless anyone else knows more. It's very complicated following these things. But those generics have consistently been proved to be as good as the patented medicines.
I thought so, with the success in Brazil. Yeah. Because generics, for me, are one of the ways forward. Now, Kenya made its own generic drugs, but they're held in stability rooms because of the patents, eh?
Right. I mean, the thing that seems to me difficult to understand is that Brazil, as you say, has gone ahead and done this, and some other countries have. And actually, they seem to be getting away with it. So I don't know why. You know, some countries have the capacity.
Independent, maybe.
Yeah. Yes, and some countries have the capacity, and Brazil already has a big pharmaceutical industry. So. Yeah.
Right, and I wanted to endorse. I work in the field and I support families who are affected and infected. And it's the hardest thing that I've ever had to deal with. And I've worked in trauma. I've worked in trauma for years and years. But it's the hardest thing for me to accept. I mean, my employers are sending me to counselling, but there's no counselling in the world will enable me to accept the fact that a lot of our families are under threat of deportation and they would be sent back, in the words of the women themselves, to risk death twice, death through the political instability, which is, I must go to the creche.
Woman's lot.
So I wanted to endorse what Eunice was saying. I can't believe that our Home Office would send women and children back to die, but that's exactly what they're prepared to do. And, you know, we have a responsibility, all of us, to highlight this issue because the women can't do it themselves because of fear of stigma.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Now she goes off to do her woman's
work.
Oh, she's a little bit depressed.
Oh, sorry. Well, that's still a woman's work. Yeah, sorry, I'll use a chair for a second, but you know, what Anne's saying is definitely true about the big issue. Want to do a story at the moment on HIV positive asylum seekers who have been failed and are about to be sent back home, specifically because the election's come up and they want to embarrass Labour. But trying to actually get a positive asylum seeker to speak to the media is impossible. They won't do it. And it's very hard because they don't want to be known in any way. I mean, even though there were restrictions in it, they couldn't name them and there'd be no photographs and all that. But they're just scared that someone else within the community will find out.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, there's no point. People have been doing it for so many years and nothing has happened. People are frustrated. No one would want to come out and say, here I am, I'm speaking as an asylum seeker. And the next thing, the media is there.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But can I just add into that? I think actually it's changed because I remember when I was working in London that people weren't getting sent back if they were positive. You know, it was seen as something that you could use legally to keep people here. And now, quite recently, and suddenly we've had this massive shift where that's not stopping them go back at all. And one of the arguments is, well, there is treatment in these countries, but the treatment is, you know, I don't know, a few hundred people who are
rich,
wealthy middle classes living in urban cities, and unless they're very lucky, you know, that is who is getting access to treatment. So I think those arguments, it's very worrying, and those arguments don't stand up at all.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else would like to keep your hand up there?
No. Talking about getting information to the asylum seekers in the form of packs and the fact that they've got so many other things to deal with, they won't actually look at those things. How do you think the best way of getting information to them is?
One of the things I would only say is make it as literal as possible, simplified, straightforward, and also just to go there. You know, the few women I interviewed who had children, very young children, had been here for over a year, and they were told you were assigned a health visitor. Now, when you say health, to me, if you tell me I'm assigned a health visitor, I expect that visitor to come to me before I can actually go to them. And what the system expects is that the African women to make the first move to go to the health visitor, which they are not doing. And they had been here for over a year. No one had any health visitor gone to their homes. So you make the information as simple and as straightforward as possible. And honestly, even me, I thank God I don't have many issues to think about. The last thing I want is to sit down now and say, GP, page 5, you know, things like that. When I've got other things to think, my child is probably not well. My house is leaking, which I found in one of the homes. The house is leaking, and where the leak was, that's where the gas tanks and everything else was, you know. You are worried about those things, and I know the resources are very stretched, but as I said, if you visit one person or two, chances are that they will tell their friends are very high.
Yeah, okay. A couple of things. I'm not actually here, I'm in a personal capacity, but I work for an organisation in Glasgow Medical Centre Vice Bureau, which is the first CAB in the UK. We've developed an asylum seeker and refugee project. Prior to that, I worked for a number of years in London in an HIV advice project. And I think it's depressing, having worked in the voluntary sector for 10 years, that we're here and the debate about racism, about race, around HIV is the same as what it was 10 years ago, but it's actually a lot worse. If you look at the current election coverage, it's just disgusting. There's no other words. It's disgusting, that, and also the lies and the misconception people have around refugees and asylum seekers, and the fact that I don't know how many millions have actually been spent on the election campaign, let alone on it. But in terms of your point around asylum seekers in HIV, our project is now extended to Parkhead and Pollock CAB, and we're training asylum seekers and refugees to actually be delivering advice within the services, so I'll be happy to exchange details afterwards. There is importance also, I think, encouraging people wherever possible to do legal challenges in the UK context. When I was in London, we referred a case of an HIV positive asylum seeker, was 8.5 months pregnant, who was to try and stop her being dispersed, but we have to, it's shameful. But there are challenges of, in theory, NAS can increase their awards if there are exceptional circumstances, people can have community care assessments if they've got a severe disability, but they're given the runaround, so it's important to keep fighting and to keep referring people for advice. One of the questions, we've heard a lot about treatment, but maybe, I'm not sure if you're able to comment or anybody here is able to comment, what's happening in terms of prevention?
Oh, well, that's...
in Africa.
Yeah, that is a very... I was just talking to people at the MRC here in Glasgow at the moment who are doing a lot of the evaluation for that. I mean, that is such a depressing field at the moment. In Africa, it's just appalling. So what we've got since Bush's second election is this massive push from American funding to say, you know, no use of condoms. I mean, they've had the global gag rule for a while, so if you've got American funding, you couldn't give, that funding couldn't be obtained by organisations that gave information about abortions, or that gave information about organisations that gave information about abortions, so excluded lots of people. But what you've got is the same thing happening now with prevention around condom use, and then you've also got even the treatment centres. All the American PEPFAR money that's going for treatment has to go through faith-based organisations. So suddenly there's this massive control happening and a big shift away from what were quite good prevention programmes to much more control. I don't know if you want to add to that, but that, you know, I just see it as the most depressing thing, and none of this has been evaluated. So, you know, they always say it's going to be evidence-based. There's no evidence to show that abstinence works, And in fact, there's quite a lot of evidence to the contrary. I just think it's the most depressing moment, you know. And people's, what I've read is, well, pharmaceutical companies don't want to do anything. No one wants to put money into it because it's not going to make profit. It's just going to make people, I don't know if that's cynical, but it just, even the best programs don't seem to be that effective, and very depressing scenario, really.
No, I had a story about in South Africa where the midwives were going round. Well, some of you have heard this story, but basically the midwives were going around doing some prevention work with the woman, and given that, you know, the women are quite dominated by the men in Africa, and, you know, if the woman say, we don't use a condom, you're not having sex, then terrible things can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So they showed the woman actually how to use a condom, and they didn't have the model of the penis to use it, so what they did was they used broom handles in order to show them to put it on, and then they came back 6 months later and the woman were pregnant, and they said, but we showed you how to use them, why didn't you use them? Oh, we put them on the broomstick every night.
I think the only thing we have to think about when it comes to prevention is you don't take the European model into Africa because it won't work. From my understanding, up till very recently, an African man had to decide what type of sex he wanted, whether he wanted sex with a condom or just wanted sex like that. And even now, there are still some ministers who are saying, why go to a shop, you buy a sweet and eat it wrapped? And that's a government minister. But coming to your question of prevention, really, for me, from my own opinion, I would say I think we still have to go back to the drawing board and start from where we started earlier on. Because as soon as I had said, those are the arguments we had in Bangkok to say abstinence doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't just work. You can't stand there and tell teenagers or people of about 20, 30 years and say, wait until your time comes. It doesn't work because we all know sex is a natural thing which people have to do. Therefore, that's why we say, when you are looking at prevention messages, I think we need a combination of all that we have rather than just one thing. That's the ABC and in Bangkok, KMCNN, whatever, negotiation and needle exchange and things like that. So, we are still lagging behind in terms of sending prevention messages and the health promotion issues, interventions.
And actually, just remind me, because what I said was, you know, it's depressing in that field. There's other areas where there's very good prevention stuff. So with drug users, it's simple. We know it works. Give out clean needles, it works very well. But they're not doing that in Eastern Europe at the moment. And that's really proven to have worked. I mean, Scotland's a brilliant example of that. We know mother-to-child transmission can work. We know how to prevent HIV transmission there to under 1%. So we know we can do that. You know, so there are areas where we've got really clear stuff about prevention. The area that's very difficult is sex, and particularly heterosexual sex, which is, you know, the main risk for African women now is to get married. I mean, how do you deal with those things at that level? It's very hard. But certainly if you're on treatment and your viral load is cut down, you're less infectious, and so that is a form of prevention as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not completely, but it does reduce infection.
We have time for any more contributions, sorry. Unless we're doing over lunch a wee bit.
You could take one more.
You want to do that? Yeah, take one more.
My name is Esther. I'm a nurse by profession. I come from South Africa. I'm an immigrant here. On the question of HIV/AIDS, I think when it comes to prevention or whatever, at times we have to be realistic here, because even if condoms are distributed as many as we know, our children are explorative. They always want to see and to feel what is beyond that. You can distribute condoms, you can tell them what to do. They have enough education at times, even at schools, even those who are literate. But when it comes to using condoms, they don't adhere. Otherwise, we wouldn't have teenage pregnancies. And I mean, I exclude the rapes. I'm merely talking about sexual relations which have been agreed upon by two people. It's very difficult, and maybe we could, along the line, be realistic and think along as to which maybe ways will really help in this, because really no one adheres, and we have young couples who also have to bear children. I mean, if you get into marriages, you get into a married life because you want to produce a family and have families. And in the meantime, we're not going, it is impossible for couples to be able to guard each other as to where is my husband, or where has my, is my, my where is my husband communicating with or mixing with where, and or my wife mixing with where. In the, at the end of the day, in the evening, young couples come together and they meet together and they have their sexual life as normal as possible. Even those who have cheated outside, when they come back, it is a normal life. And that's where AIDS sometimes comes from, because someone will be infected from somewhere, and when she comes, she infects a partner, or he infects a partner. And at the end of the day, our sister has already said, in Africa, always when men are infected, they are infected by women, but we don't know where women get infection from.
I think that's why I was saying we have to go back to the basics, because when it comes to prevention messages, you don't just ponder on one item. I think what I've found of late, we've forgotten to actually talk about the issues around HIV. I attended a conference where they said, actually, I'm not going to go into defining what HIV is and what have you, because you all know. How do you know we know? You know. So I think we have to. It's very difficult to a situation to say okay, because obviously, as you have said, some people do ignore the condom issues. But it's very difficult. But as long as we keep on talking about certain things, the basics, you know, people understand the basics about HIV and how it's transmitted, particularly in African countries where the main route of infection is sexual intercourse. I think we just have to keep on talking about it and just go back to the basics, as it were. Because as you have said, blame, and I said here that blame is always on the woman. Not necessarily on the woman. Whoever is diagnosed first is doomed to be blamed, to say you are the one who brought it upon your partner. And those are the issues which we have to talk about, talk through. And I think when it comes to HIV, there shouldn't be any taboos. Because the taboo was me as a mother wouldn't talk to my child about sex and other things. I think we have reached a stage whereby we have no choice but to talk about it.
Yeah. Right, we need to finish up now. Sorry. I just made a couple of announcements before I ask speakers to sum up. The creche needs two volunteers over lunchtime to help watch five children, because their mothers are dancing. It's part of the entertainment, so if anyone would like to volunteer, you could go down to the creche. The other thing, a couple of books here. This is not a new book. There's a book stall downstairs, but this is a new one that's been given to me. It's called The No-Nonsense Guide to HIV and AIDS. It's £7. And also, The Arguments Against the G8, which is a new book, which has been edited by Jill Hubbard, who spoke this morning, and David Miller, who's speaking this afternoon, with the contributions from Chomsky, George Monbiot, Caroline Lucas, Mark Curtis, and Susan George. I don't have a price on it. Do you get a price?
£10.
£10. And they're downstairs. I would recommend them to people. The other thing, you probably got a leaflet on your seat about Marxism, which is an event that's happening in
No, rather than summing up, actually, the gentleman there had a question to ask, so.
Oh.
I think we're talking about abstinence, and I think the problem with abstinence is it sends out mixed messages. Because if we say safe sex is safe and you will not get HIV from it, Why say cut down on the number of partners you have, or like, cut out sex altogether? So people look at it and think, well, why should I practice safe sex? It doesn't work. So people tend to reject it. And one of the worst things that I've heard recently, apart from the Indian thing, is Uganda. And Uganda used to have a very good safe sex programme, but is now under pressure from America, adopted the abstinence programme and withdrawing free condoms on the grounds that they weren't safe or they were faulty, which I think is nonsense, to be honest. And now you have a country with a relatively low rate of infection of HIV, and is now starting to rise, and you're now seeing the disaster on the make in Uganda with HIV. And I think if you look at what America's doing to the world, it's trying to do to the world what it's already done to its own working class, smashed the social systems, smashed wages and unions and so on, sweatshops, transfer work into Mexico and so on. And I think they're doing that to the rest of the world through the World Bank, through trips and so on. And I think that's the way to understand what is happening in the world and why George Bush is hell-bent and killing as many Africans as possible, it seems like. You know, it's absolutely appalling.
And that Uganda's been the example that's been used a lot to say abstinence worked. So, you know, it's a very interesting case. But George Monbiot wrote a really excellent article about that and how America's own sexual health policies have been so disastrous, you know, that they can't preach to the world. It's on his website. It's very, very good. Yeah. Sum up. What we didn't make was make the connections, but obviously they're part of the same system, what we're both talking about. So that can be our summing up.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Some in this country. In our country, we have churches of African origin ministers. They are called independent churches. You find that those ministers do not receive funding from anywhere. They don't even have money to build churches. They pray sometimes in private, in the garages, private rooms.